Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Ask Katie Anything. I'm your host, licensed marriage and family therapist, Katie Morton. I'm so glad that you're here. In today's episode, I am going to talk about therapy hangovers and whether or not those are a real thing. I'm also going to explain why talking positively to ourselves can sometimes give us the icks and why we cannot like it if our therapist tells us that they enjoy their job. Then I'm going to talk about how we can ask our therapist to support us when we're having a hard time. And I'm going to explain the reasons why we cannot want to talk about our eating habits in therapy. And finally, my experience working in community mental health. Without further ado, let's
just... Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Come to the first question. This question says, hey, Katie, I hope you're doing well. I am. I hope you're doing well. My question is about therapy hangovers. Is it even real? If it is real, how does one deal with it and how long should it last? Now, there's an add-on to this, but let's just jump right in. Now, yes, therapy hangovers are a thing. I've talked about them personally when I share with you guys my feelings or things I'm going through online. I have like a vulnerability hangover, meaning that I feel like I was vulnerable. It's to a lot of people. And I do struggle with the kind of the hangover effect of it, meaning I feel kind of like drained. I'm a little bit exhausted. I'm also acutely aware of like how people perceive it and perceive me. And I just feel a little bit kind of too seen, if that makes sense. Almost like I've shown you icky parts of myself. And I'm like, ooh, you know, that kind of experience. Therapy hangovers are just that. And I think this can happen for a couple of reasons. Like I said, the first is us sharing parts of ourselves we don't normally share, and it can make us feel really vulnerable, the vulnerability hangover, right? Like I showed you some of these things that I don't like about myself, and I'm trying to process that. So that's a piece of it. The next could be the fact that I'll, even in my own therapy, if I have a really emotionally taxing session, that in and of itself is exhausting. I'm like hungover from it because all of the like emotional upheaval can leave me totally wiped out. And so, yes, I believe therapy hangovers can happen and most likely will happen from time to time. Now, how do we deal with it and how long should it last? The thing that I want to express here is that these shouldn't happen every single time. If this is happening with every single session and it knocks us out for the whole day or the next day or whatever, maybe multiple days, maybe until we see them the next time, let your therapist know, because that to me is an indicator that we're doing too much too fast. We don't feel regulated when we leave session at all, and we're left kind of like trying to piece it together, feeling overwhelmed and still completely dysregulated, right? And that's not what our goal is. Therapy should help us move forward. In between sessions, we're supposed to try different things out. Maybe that's changes of behavior. Maybe that's a little insight and journaling or just thinking about a certain topic. I want you to feel like you have the wherewithal or the bandwidth to do that in between sessions. And if we're completely hungover from it, feeling overwhelmed and maxed out, not only do I find that that can lead us to using unhealthy coping skills in between session because we feel so dysregulated, but it can also mean that we never get to try those other things out because we don't feel well enough to do it. So it should not last more than the day of therapy. Like when you go to sleep and you wake up the next day, you should feel back to your normal self, okay? And that's obviously, if we're doing trauma work, I'd give you like maybe another day. But again, let your therapist know if it's lasting too long, because while therapy hangovers are normal, it shouldn't be like running your life. We don't want you to feel totally wiped out, dysregulated, overwhelmed all the time. That means therapy is actually kind of being detrimental to our life, not helpful, right? And then the final part of this question says, if it is real, how do you deal with it? And the truth is, it's okay to feel worn out for that day. And that's why I encourage people, if possible, to do a therapy session at the end of your day. So that when you, like, let's say you can leave work maybe an hour early, you get to your therapy at 4 or 5 o'clock, then you go home. Or maybe we do it, you know, in our lunch hour, we only have a couple more hours left to work, and we, whatever you're able to squeeze in, or we do it on the weekend. I mean, as a therapist, I think all of us would like agree, we tend to work nights and weekends, which I know kind of sucks. Like it can be hard for us. That's like work-life balance and things that we have to figure out. But in my office, I don't do 7 a.m. patients. Some people do that. I don't do before work patients, but some therapists do. But my day never started. I think the earliest it started was like 2 or 3 p.m. And that was because most people, you know, the earliest they'll do is like around lunchtime. Like I did have some patients I would do like supportive lunches, you know, like the meal support sessions out, and that would be like noon, but never was it earlier. And then I'd work until like 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock at night. And that's just because people get out of work and that allows you to wind down. And so the way to deal with it is really to try to allow for the time, meaning that if we know we're going to be hungover for like 3 or 4 hours after, let's make sure we don't have anything important or big to do. Even if we do have to go back to work, can it just be kind of like email catch up and stuff like that? Are those things we think we could focus on or do? Or could it just be us working on our own? You know, assess for yourself. But there's no real way to deal with it. I don't want you to feel like this is something that has to be dealt with immediately. I think this is something, or it's often something that we just need to let ourselves feel, let ourselves process it through. If we're doing this tough work, it's okay to feel dysregulated for a little bit. It just shouldn't be going on days and days and days, and it shouldn't be every single time we go to therapy, okay? There was an add-on that said, how do you go on with your quote-unquote normal day after therapy? I see two different therapists, and one has a later schedule, so I'm able to see her after work and go home after therapy. Beautiful, love it. The other one I see before work, and we specifically work on anxiety and doing exposures due to trauma. Before work? Ooh. However, after session, I have to go to work and act like everything's fine the rest of the day, even though I always feel dysregulated. Yeah. Yuck. What can I do to get my session out of my head and go on with my day after working through such tough things in therapy? Ask your therapist if you can do some containment exercises. And there's a lot of different ways we can do this. One way, this isn't ideal. Like you said, it sucks. It has to be early. If there's a way for you to move it later and you can like take your lunch time or all of your break time and squish it there, at least that saves us a few hours. But before you end sessions, your therapist needs to do some containment exercises. Now, these can be anything. I used to have a patient that, because she loved Little Mermaid, that's a story for another time, but she would imagine she goes into like Ariel's. If you don't remember Little Mermaid, don't worry. But Ariel has this like little area she goes to where she keeps all of the things that she's found from the land out there, like the above water land. And she has her little trinkets, like fork, you know, and all the things that they don't really know what they're called, but they give them funny names. But she imagined that she would go in there and she would put what we worked on in therapy in this little like apothecary bottle and put a cork in it and put it into her own little area like that, okay? So we need to do something like that for you. In my own therapy, I imagine it's like this wood carved box. And it's like, it's beautiful. It's like maple. It's like this caramely brown color. And it has this really intricate lock that goes on it. And it's huge. I open it up. And my therapist tells me to put all the thoughts and emotions and things that we're working on in therapy into the box. And I close my eyes for this because it can be a little woo-woo. She's like, just leave it here with me and we'll open it up next time. And then the next session, we open it back up. And I know that can sound kind of woo-woo, a little weird, but believe me when I tell you that it is a nice kind of ritual or routine to get into in therapy, because it allows us to like visually put, let's say you said you're doing exposures due to trauma and anxieties. Imagine we take that trauma story and we put it in there and we see younger us and we all the anxiety we feel, all the overwhelm, all the dysregulation. We imagine just almost like I tip my head and I pour it into the thing and then I shut the top and I lock it. Taking time to do that ritual and that routine allows for you to leave it there so that the dysregulation won't affect you the rest of the day. And it might take a couple different types of things. Like I used to think that my little container was looked different. I thought it was gonna be a bottle. That didn't feel big enough. You might feel like you want tiny little things. You wanna squish them in there. I don't know. A wood box might not work for you, but consider it might be like a big closet, like Monica Geller's closet in Friends that she puts all her stuff in. Whatever it has to look like for you, let's try that and tell your therapist you need to do some containment because you're feeling dysregulated. Because again, our goal as therapists is to challenge you, but also not to make the rest of your life worse, right? We don't want to make you so dysregulated you have to go to work and feel terrible. If I was seeing you at like 7 a.m., there's no way I want to like leave you all frazzled out. I'd want to make sure that you feel okay and you're able to like go do what you need to do that day. So let them know you're struggling with this. I'm sure they can come up with other ways to help you calm down, contain, and then move into your day. So those are just some ideas, but containment exercises, every therapist knows them. You know, let them know what's happening and they can hopefully help you do that next time so that work's not so hard. Okay, let's move on.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
And question number two. This question says, Katie, how does one get used to positive talk when their whole life they've been shit-talked to? I get the ick with compliments and when someone shows that they care. This is a great question. And the thing about it is that positive talk feels weird, right? If we're not used to it, it's super uncomfortable. We're like, what do they want from me? I used to have a patient that would think that if someone gave her a compliment, that meant that they were going to harm her later. And we tied it back to some like trauma and abuse in her past. But for a lot of us, compliments weren't things that were given. We don't know why people are saying it, and it can put us on edge because it feels unpredictable. It feels a little out of control, right? And so the way that we get used to this is by talking more positively to ourselves using bridge statements. And the reason I say it this way is because bridge statements are not positive. They're just not as negative. And so if we're used to people talking shit to us, saying we're stupid, lazy, ugly, fat, whatever, dumb, they hate you, they hate the way your hair looks, I don't know. People can say all sorts of mean, terrible things. So whatever they said that we don't want to be called that feels bad to us and inauthentic, but we're used to it. So let's take those statements or those comments that we've received, those hateful, honestly, emotionally abusive comments, and let's make them open to change. Meaning that if the thought or if the comment is, you're so stupid and lazy, and I know I've used that one before, I don't know why, maybe it's something that I've heard because I feel like I come up with that one on my own, so my apologies. And then the bridge statement would be, you know, I'm open to the thought that while I am stupid and sometimes lazy, remember, sometimes that's different, it's a little less negative, I do believe that there might be other people out there that are dumber than I am. Yeah. See, that's not really positive, but it's not as negative. It's sometimes lazy. We changed some phrasing there. And the possibility that there are people out there who are dumber than I am. Again, I know that just seems not right. You're like, Katie, but that doesn't even feel quite like good. Trust me when I tell you that you will feel that slight difference. And from that, so you've put a new plank on your bridge with that statement that we just went through. Then I want you to put another one. So the next time we find ourselves having the same thought, you know, I'm lazy and stupid. We're like, remember, sometimes lazy, and there probably are other people that are dumber than me. Then the next plank might be, you know, I've realized that there are quite a few times that maybe I'm not lazy. And I've recognized that people out there are dumber than I am. More definitive. Again, not positive, but not as negative. And so we're just moving slowly towards what the goal would be, is that I recognize that I can actually be pretty productive. I'm not lazy and I'm pretty smart. That would be like the goal, right? But we have to move there slowly. And I believe that that allows us to kind of untrain our brain and body from thinking that compliments aren't good or that they're weird and give us the icks or that something bad is going to happen when we are complimented, right? We've been trained to think that negative stuff is real and it's true and that's what we can believe. And that's just like almost the routine or ritual that we've had. We've created this new routine or ritual in our life where we're not talking to ourselves really nastily. And we can slowly prove or disprove that nasty belief and prove that compliments are good and that we can offer them to ourselves and other people can and we can believe them. But it's a slow process, right? We've been like completely brainwashed into thinking that the negative stuff is true and the positive stuff isn't, or that the negative stuff is like safe and the positive stuff isn't. And so we have to learn a new belief system while like essentially deprecating or getting rid of the old one. And that takes time. And so be patient with yourself as you challenge. Again, remember, you know, none of these thoughts are supposed to be positive. They're just supposed to be not as negative. So be patient with yourself as you work through this because it does take some time. Okay. Let's move on to question number three. This question says, hi, Katie, Why do I hate it when my therapist says that he loves his job and that he really enjoys working with his patients? When he says that, it only makes me feel like I'm there for his entertainment. I feel like a circus freak. Like I'm only there for him to study and learn from. Don't get me wrong. I'd rather he liked his job than he hated it. But when he says that, it really makes me feel like I'm there for him instead of him being there for me. Does that make sense? I also cannot stand it when he says that what I'm going through is normal. Again, don't get me wrong. I don't want to be special in any way, but it feels minimizing when he says that. That what I'm feeling or going through is normal. I understand that whatever I'm going through is quote unquote normal within my specific diagnosis. I have DID, that stands for dissociative identity disorder. But I just can't shake the feeling of being minimized. It's like my mind goes, well, if it's so damn normal, then I should be able to get over it. Why am I so hung up on this when it apparently happens to everyone? Any and all insight would be greatly appreciated. Thanks for your insight and help. Of course. Now, a couple pieces here. First is that to hear that a therapist loves their job can make us feel, because I think, here's the rub, I think. Because therapy is so difficult for us as the patient, even if we like it and we want to go to it because it's helpful, it's hard, right? We can feel dysregulated. We feel overwhelmed like we were just talking about before. And so if a therapist is like, oh, I love the work that I do, we're like, but I feel icky. This is hard for me. I can't believe you're having a good time. You know what I mean? It's like if you, let's say you brought a friend with you to a really difficult doctor's appointment. I'm just making something up. And they're like, oh, this is so enjoyable. And you're like, I might get a cancer diagnosis today, right? Like, how dare you fucking enjoy yourself? It can feel like that. And I have a feeling that that's kind of what's going on. And the truth about it is that we just have to tell our therapist. And I know a lot of you are like, Katie, you always say that. But there's nothing we can do with this other than to let our therapist know. Because your therapist can't, I mean, they cannot mention it again, but we have to let them know not to mention it again. And if they say that they enjoy their job, it's going to be upsetting to us. And we could challenge that thought or belief. I mean, we could dig into like, where do we think this comes from? But I think that's a natural reaction when we're like, this is a hard place for me to be. It's hard work. I benefit from it. I'm grateful for it. But to hear that you enjoy it just doesn't feel quite right. Wherever that comes from, if that has like a deep root in something else, our therapist is going to have to help us discover that. And so we have to tell them that we are thinking like this, that this belief system is coming up, because it's not as simple as like, oh, you know, we could try to reframe it. Like you said, like I want my therapist to enjoy their job. I don't want them to hate it, but it makes us feel like a circus freak, you know? So I guess we could reframe it to say like, I'm glad that my therapist enjoys their job because that means they work harder for me, which is kind of true. So maybe if that helps, you could try to keep, whenever that thought comes up, you tell yourself that reframe. But other than that, we're going to have to tell our therapist, because then we can work on it. Like, where is this coming from? Why do we think like this? What is it about us feeling like a circus freak? Have we been told that before? Do we feel like that? Is that something that someone has said to us? Why does our brain go there? Is that something that maybe our family has said to us? Where did we learn that? Why is that our automatic thought? Just curious. But that would be work you'd have to, you know, do with your therapist. So I would let them know. Now, that totally makes sense. Also, like I said, that rub of it being uncomfortable for you and him being like, I love my job. And you're like, what? Feels icky. And then the second piece about like saying that things are normal. Language is so important as a therapist and in therapy as a whole that you have to tell your therapist this, because there's other words that I've heard from many of you, and I am acutely aware in my own practice when I had one. If anybody doesn't know, I don't practice anymore. When we moved to Texas, I shut my office in Santa Monica. Have not opened one up yet here, even though I am licensed in Texas. But there's so many words that we have to be careful of. Like one that I was always very cautious of saying was just like, oh, it's not borderline personality disorder. You just self-injure. It's not part of that. Saying just is a very minimizing term. It's just depression. It's not bipolar depression. It's just this, oh, you're just going through a divorce. You're just, and it obviously when I'm saying them in short succession like this, you're like, who would talk like that? We say stuff like that all the time without realizing it. And so as a therapist, we have to be acutely aware of how our language could be interpreted. Your therapist doesn't realize that normal is triggering for you. When they're doing it as a way to help you feel like you're not alone, they're doing it as like a kind of like a hug, but it feels the opposite. It feels like push away, right? So, or minimization, really. So let them know. And I also, you know, might challenge you to consider why normal feels so minimizing. Like, can we think about that? Like, is it because you feel like you should just be able to get over it? Does normal mean that normal people don't have problems? Does it mean normal people don't need therapy? What's it mean to be normal? Because there might be something in there too, like in the definition, again, or not again, but for the first time, definitions when I mention these in therapy aren't for us to write down or journal or think about like what the actual Webster's definition is, what Webster's dictionary. I want it to be true to you. How do you define it? This isn't correct. This is true for you. Does that make sense? I'm not looking to grade you on how authentic it is. It needs to be real for you. So what does normal mean? Does normal mean no problems, wouldn't need therapy, shouldn't have to, you know, what does that mean? Because it sounds like your therapist is saying that what you're going through is a normal human response, that like even with DID, like the way that your brain is trying to manage and mitigate the trauma, DID is a very normal response to trauma. That doesn't mean that it's not hard or doesn't affect our life or isn't in some ways, you know, I don't know, made keeping a job really difficult or keeping relationships really difficult or affected us in bad ways. That just means that it's okay. Like our brain does operate that way. That is normal. There's nothing like, you're not crazy. I think that might be what your therapist is saying. And that's like a reframe again, right? We could reframe it, but there's something here. And so I'd want you to define that. And you're hung up on this because it's hard for you. There's clearly something in your past or, you know, recent past, almost present, potentially, where you believe that like you don't have a right to maybe take up space. You maybe don't have a right to feel as bad as you feel. You maybe don't have a right to get help. Maybe even going to therapy feels kind of like you're taking it from someone else. I hear from a lot of you that you feel like if you're not really struggling, whatever that means, then you don't have a right to take up that hour because you feel like you're removing it from someone else. And I'm here to tell you, you're all deserving of care. And I feel like the person who asked this question may not feel deserving of care. And so we're very sensitive to language that our therapists use. And so let your therapist know so they can be aware, because as a therapist, I would want to know so I could make notes that I don't use words like normal and I don't talk about how much I enjoy my job, even if I do, because those things are triggering to you for some reason. And yes, we can dig into the reasons behind it. But in the meantime, why would I keep saying that if it's making it hard for you? Do you know what I mean? So let them know. We have to dig into kind of where this is coming from for you. Because like I said, I think there's some kind of worthiness or worth issues that we're running into. And those can be teased out. I'd assume they're probably part of like trauma slash the reason we have DID. But no, I don't know for sure. But we have this belief for some reason that, you know, in order for us to warrant care or for us to be worthy, specific things have to happen. And this is really throwing us off. So let your therapist know and see what you find. Okay. Let's move on to question number four. This question is, hey, Katie, I was having a hard time during my last therapy session. I didn't want to talk much and I felt really, really low. My therapist asked how she can support me. I have no idea what to say. So I just told her that I didn't know. What does she mean when she asks this? You should ask her. What kinds of support can she give during the therapy session? I do remote therapy, by the way. Thank you for all that you do. Of course. And there are a couple of comments. There's quite a few add-ons on this one. Very popular. It's glad that you told me it's remote, because in session, there's probably more that we can do depending on what you want. Meaning that if we're in session, I had a patient, and I think I've talked about this before, like that would want me to put my hand on her upper back. It was like right between her shoulder blades. That was a safe spot, and like pat, and that would bring her back. Or I could just sit closer to her. I could scoot my chair forward. I could, you know, do things like that in person. But when you're doing things remotely, there's still a ton that you can do. For instance, if you find yourself dissociating or spacing out or struggling to make eye contact, as a therapist, I can call attention to that. I can say, I've noticed you're looking awake, and then I'll instruct you to do some grounding techniques. Things like, can you tell me how many things in the room are blue? Are you able to do that? Could you look, I've done this with my patients before. I'm like, could you look at my hand? Can we focus over here? Is that okay? Can we do that? And then slowly move it closer to my face. Just things to help bring you back or to help you feel okay. Patting you on the back, sitting closer. Obviously, those are things like in person, but your therapist could instruct you to get like a weighted blanket or put that over your shoulders or whatever. They're just asking for how they can best support you. What are the things that are helpful for you? What verbally could they do to either help bring you back, help calm you down, Should they run you through a breathing exercise? Should you do some grounding techniques? Things like that. It's okay that you said you didn't know. I'm surprised they didn't come up with some options. Like usually if my patient's like, I don't know, I just feel overwhelmed. I'm like, would it be helpful? Do you feel like dysregulated, like you need to be grounded? Like, let's do that and we'll do some counting the colors or whatever. Or, you know, are you feeling like a little overwhelmed? Do you wanna like rub on your arms? Do like the butterfly hug? Does that help? There's different things that we can do. You know, breathing exercise, breathe in for four, hold for four, out for four. But come back with some of those ideas and give them a try. Or if any of them sounded good, you're like, oh, that would have been helpful. Then write that down. Let your therapist know, because they're just asking how they can best support you so that they don't do something to make it worse. Because unfortunately, like many of my patients have had trauma in their past. And if I automatically assume that they wanted me to touch them on the arm or whatever, I could send them into a worse flashback or a worse dissociative state. And that's not what we want to do. One of the opposite, right? And so they were just checking in to see if there were certain ways that they could show up for you and help you feel a little bit better. Because you said you felt really low. So I don't know if that means, you know, just down and depressed. Maybe breathing is helpful. Maybe they could. I used to have this patient who would want me to tell her like funny stories. And so I would just like distract her with silly stories sometimes. You know, just goofy things from childhood or a funny thing my friend did or an embarrassing thing I said, you know, there's things like that. So just consider what would be helpful and let your therapist know. But those are just some ideas and I hope that that helps you. Now, there was a comment that says, as an add-on, I do in-person therapy. My therapist does the same thing. Recently, she's been asking how she can help me keep from zoning out, dissociating. I feel bad when I tell her I don't know, but I really don't know what to say. Can you help? Tell her you feel yourself pulling away. You need grounding techniques. Those are what those are called. Like I said, I mentioned like counting colors, like how many things are blue, how many things are gray, how many things are black or brown. You can also do the alphabet where like look around the room, how many things start with the letter A, how many things start with letter B, C, and so on. You can also stomp your feet and clap your hands. They can touch you on the arm or back if that's okay. Those are all things that they can help you with. Just let them know that you need grounding techniques because you feel yourself zoning out. The other person says, on a similar note, my therapist and support system, mostly immediate family, also ask me how they can best support me. I'm in active eating disorder recovery, by the way. I never know what to tell them. Asking for anything feels wrong. That's interesting, right? But I genuinely don't know what to ask for outside of keeping safe foods on hand and stocked in the house. My parents are really eager and willing to help, but I don't know what to tell them. I know it's partly because of my hyper-independence shining through in most of these situations as well, but is there anything vague or broad that I could ask them to do? It feels like I'm just giving them busy work, but at least they feel like they're helping. You're really concerned about them. I find this like people-pleasing stuff coming out more than your hyper-independence because you're like, you don't want to make them do anything. Not that you're making them, but you don't even want to ask them for anything because it feels wrong. There's something in there about worth, worthiness, like you're that it's okay to ask for help. You, for some reason, don't believe that it is. I'd be interested in that. But what you could tell them is to talk with your therapist and come up with what would be most helpful. Like the things that automatically come to my mind when I think of like eating disorders and families and recovery is telling them not to mention how we look, not to mention our body, our weight, our clothes, anything like that could be triggering, to mention things like you look really happy. You seem like you're having a good day. It's good to see you, like basic things like that. I do a ton of education with my clients, like spouses, parents, friends, when it comes to that stuff. The safe foods is a good one. If it's helpful for you, you can say like, hey, could you guys eat with me? You know, like it's best if people eat with me and like pace yourself with me. That stuff can help. But other than that, I mean, you'd have to think about it because everybody's different. You can tell them not to talk about their own weight or body. Like I had patients who were super triggered by people saying that they worked out XYZ amounts or did this or, oh, I shouldn't have that. You know, like that kind of stuff can be triggering. So letting them know about that, like language and behaviors and things that can be triggering for you, you can tell them that. But other than that, you know, having the food on hand, checking in with you, making sure they're not commenting, all that stuff is great. And I would dig into why it feels bad to ask to get help from them. Like you said, it, you know, that anything, asking for anything feels wrong. I'm very curious about that. I'd let your therapist know that that came up. Okay. Final, two more add-ons. This add-on says, I've been open with my therapist from day one that I struggle with dissociation, and that's why I need it in person. When I start to space out, we focus on small talk, finding colors around the room, and sometimes if I'm really bad, they come over and rub my arm or shoulder to help me. Look at this, it's beautiful. They often tell me to try standing up and going for a walk around the room, and they'll go and do it with me. I feel frozen. I just sit there shaking my head, and then I feel like I've disappointed them. They don't say that I have, though. Should I push through it and just stand up, or should I tell them that I'm struggling to do this right now, even though I know it'll help? I don't really know what I need from them or what will work. You're doing great. You can let them know. They obviously are aware. You don't even have to let them know that you can't do that one. Even if it'll help, that doesn't mean we're always able to do it. It might be too far gone. The goal then would be to start doing these things earlier on. And I'd let them know, like, hey, I'm too far into this. Maybe next time. And obviously we'll do this when we're not in a dissociative state. But at the beginning of your next session, you can say, I know standing up and walking around the room really helps me, but I find by the time we do it, I'm too far gone. So maybe we can try that earlier on. Like maybe that's one of your first interventions, you know, because that tells us that even because you said it will help, but we're at a space where we can't. And that's all helpful information. You're not letting them down. They're just trying a bunch of different things, just like I said. And all of the tools and things that they're using to help you keep grounded is great. And so, I would just let them know. I think that if something isn't working, they need to know. Because you said, I don't really know what I need from them or what will work. We try things out. That's why I give a bunch of options. It sounds like there are a ton of options. We don't know what's going to work until we try them. So give them a go. And if certain things do work, just let them know. And if they don't work, let them know. Those are both really important. And like if the getting up and walking around ends up not helping, tell them. But we have to try them out. Unfortunately, we don't know until we try them. And we're not going to know if they work when we're just like wanting to dissociate unless we use them when we're in that space. So it just takes some time. I know it's annoying. I know it sucks kind of, but we have to try. It's like trial and error when it comes to those kinds of coping skills. Okay, final add-on. It says, I have this issue when my therapist tries to help me lower my anxiety and focus instead of dissociating. She wants me to do breathing exercises with her, and that just ramps up my anxiety. Something about doing that with another person just, I don't know. I think I feel vulnerable. Any way to overcome this? I also do remote therapy and have DID. Thanks. Let them know you don't like breathing exercises. Most people don't. Now, I will tell you that the double breath in, when we breathe in, and we do a double breath at the top to fill our lungs, and then really does calm our system. I don't like breathing exercises personally either. It makes me focus on my heartbeat, and then I'm focused on my breath, and then I start like spiraling out. It's not helpful. Let your therapist know these don't work. I honestly would say that most of my patients hate breathing exercises, so you're not alone. If you think they would work or they work on your own, do them on your own. But let your therapist know you'd like to try other things. Like we just talked about a ton of things, like counting colors. Those are things that you can do remote. Look around the room. How many things are blue? How many things are green? How many things are black? Do the alphabet. Things start with A, B, C. Those are all things. Can you stomp your feet? Can you clap your hands? Can we move around? Do we do a full body shake? All of those things are helpful. Let's try those out. Breathing just might not be the thing for you to do with your therapist. You don't have to overcome it. There's plenty of other things we can do. Maybe if we start to feel a little bit better because we've done the foot stomping or whatever, then we can do the breathing exercise. Maybe we have to take the edge off first and then do it. I don't know. We'll have to try them out. Again, trial and error. But it's not the only thing that we can do. So be honest with your therapist. Let them know. This makes me feel more anxious because I feel that way too. And then there's other things we can try. Okay? You'll get there. Moving on to question number 5, this question says, hi, Katie. My question is about not wanting to talk about my eating habits in therapy. Interesting. In one of my first few sessions, my therapist asked me about my relationship with food. I'm overweight and I don't have very healthy eating habits. I would not consider it to be an eating disorder, but who knows? A professional might disagree. They might. I told her that I've seen dietitians before and I have all the knowledge I need about healthy eating and that I'm not interested in addressing this in therapy. That's interesting. She has diagnosed me with PTSD from sexual abuse that happened when I was 23, 5 years ago, or sexual assault them. And that was what I wanted to work on. The next session, she brought up my eating habits again and advised me to see another dietitian. I probably would have too. We'll get into this. I can't help but feel frustrated. This is not what I'm here for. And after being overweight for most of my life since I was like 12, I'm so sick and tired of every health professional bringing this up. Sore throat? It's your weight. Ingrown toenail? You might want to lose some weight. Dry skin? It's probably your weight. One time I saw my doctor for pain in my shoulders and left her office with a referral for gastric surgery. Well, that's fucked. And we'll talk about this. And here we are again. Maybe I'm overreacting or even lashing out because it's such a sensitive subject. Yes. Or is it justified and I don't want to talk about this in therapy? I would love to get your opinion and hear from others who can relate. First thing I want to address up front is the stigma with being overweight and physicians. You should never go to a doctor with ingrown toenail, sore throat, and then always say it's your weight. I find that incredibly, incredibly dismissive, minimizing, frustrating, and dangerous, right? We've had people in our community who came in for pain and were sent, oh, it's just because you need to lose weight. You maybe ate fried food. Like they make these assumptions and we could have an appendix that's going to burst or have a blockage somewhere or, you know, I don't know, have an ulcer, all of which need to be treated. So that really grinds my gears, is so annoying. They need to be more well-trained than that. I find it incredibly frustrating to always blame any ailment on this one thing. So you're not wrong there. That clearly has made you very, very sensitive to the subject, rightfully so. However, I will say that therapy is the one place you should talk about it. We don't need to talk about it with a medical professional. I know people could disagree. I'm not a huge fan of gastric bypass surgery, and I know people can get mad at me about that, but it's not that I'm against it and think like, you should never. It's the fact that we're fixing, quote unquote, fixing a mental health problem with a physical surgery. If we don't fix the actual problem, our belief around food, our worth in ourselves, the struggle that we have with overeating, undereating, binging, purging, maybe restricting, binging, whatever's going on, whatever the reason is behind our weight gain over the years, we're not addressing that. And so even if we have gastric bypass, the chances of us gaining all that weight back and potentially harming ourselves more because now we have like a smaller amount of space in our stomach, that is still there and it could be even more dangerous and we could gain all the way back. So, okay. So those are my thoughts there. I could really get on a like total, you know, I don't want to get on a soapbox here, but I think that it could help you to understand your relationship with food. I would prefer for you to see a dietitian who understands eating disorders. Now, I'm not jumping to conclusions saying you have an eating disorder, but I will tell you that any of us who are, and I have a video, people in the community helped me with this, and I'm sorry. I've just never come out with this video because I couldn't figure out how to do it. I mean, maybe people will just get mad and that's just what I have to deal with, but I just haven't felt ready. But I do believe that when we are obese to the point where it is harming our health overall, it's making our life harder. It's something that people always go to, like doctors are constantly saying, we need to lose weight, blah, 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 that we have an eating disorder. And the reason that I say that is because we don't talk about overeating, binge eating disorder enough in our world and the complete disconnect so many of us have from our brain and our body. And we talk about like, oh, I'm just eating when I'm bored, or people, you know, snack and people do these things. And we normalize a lot of behaviors that I would say are ways to numb out. And it's us, if we eat until we're uncomfortably full, we could say, well, then that means we're overeating. But if we're disconnected brain from body, we don't know when we're hungry or full. We aren't going to be able to recognize we're doing that. And anyways, I don't think we talk about this enough so that we all have a greater understanding of what binge eating disorder looks like and the effects that it can have. And what you're struggling with could be that. And we need to be able to talk about it in a real way and get you real help versus just this, like, you need to eat healthy and lose weight, because that's not the problem. If that was the problem, we would have already fucking lost the weight anyway, right? I think that's my frustration with the medical model. Like I told you guys, I went to a new OBGYN, which I will not be returning to, by the way, and did my blood work. Everything was fine. My cholesterol was like, I don't know, 5 points below what could maybe be a warning, or I don't know, because there's like the pre-high cholesterol, I was like 5 points below that. And then there was high cholesterol, right? And she was like, well, it's a little elevated, I think is how she phrased it to me. I'm not a doctor. And then she said that I was obese for my height. And she sent She didn't say it in person. They sent it through in my messages and sent me a diet plan. And the frustration, the anger that I felt from receiving that, not just for me personally, but for every other woman who I know has gone to see them and has received the same fucking ridiculous advice that doesn't even account for life, doesn't even account for the fact that I could be in recovery, then ask me about any of that. She asked me if I was suicidal, which I was glad at least she had that in there. But like, are you fucking kidding me? The lack of understanding in our medical system for issues with food and body and weight is just makes me so angry. And in your scenario, of course, you're touchy because people aren't addressing it properly. They're not seeking to understand where this comes from. And you said you've been overweight since you were 12. I'm curious what was happening then. And how is food our way of coping with uncomfortable emotions or situations? Do other people in our life, like our parents or other friends, do they eat as a way to cope? Is food the one way we connected with people growing up? I think for a lot of us, that was what it was, right? My family always gets together around food. What was that like? If you said you were full, did you get more stuff flopped onto your plate? You know, want to beef you up, we need to eat more. What were the messages? And I'm saying all this hopefully to help you let that wall down a little bit, to understand that like we all need to understand and recognize our relationship with food. We don't have to be underweight, overweight, or anything to do this work. We should all be aware of how we talk to ourselves about what we eat, how we talk to our body about how it looks and what it does for us. We need to repair that relationship. And clearly we have some kind of disconnect here for you. And because it's always every issue has been blamed on it, it feels like a very touchy subject. But finding a dietitian who understands eating disorders is going to be key. I would hypothesize, and I don't know because you didn't say this, but since you had the sexual assault 5 years ago, I would be interested in your weight over the last 5 years. Has it gone up or down? Because it, you know, we might, if overeating's our thing to numb out, then I would argue it's probably gone up in that time. And again, we're just looking not as a shame-based statement or a shame-based avenue to go down in therapy, more as a way to understand how you internalize this trauma. What's happening? And you've been overweight since you were 12. What was happening then? You know, I'm just very, very curious about it. Not judgmental. This is not a space to be like, oh, this is all because of your weight. No, but there's a relationship in there when it comes to our mental health. And I want to make sure we're at least addressing that. And that's why I think it's good that they said you should see another dietitian. We need to find someone who actually gets what's happening. I don't want you to walk away with a healthy eating plan, quote unquote, healthy eating plan, and like, you need to lose weight. That's not the goal. Like, that's not how I work with my patients with binge eating disorder at all. A lot of it is us understanding what triggers a binge, what's a binge look like, and can we, you know, better mitigate our emotions in another way? And do we find our binging going up or down? We're just assessing, right? So take your time with this. I understand why you're frustrated. There's so much stigma, so much judgment, and such poor care from our medical model. Like, even myself, I called them and told them, I was like, you cannot be sending this out to people. Like, when I got that in my messages, I don't think they even took me seriously, you guys. So frustrating. So I get like a smidge of what you're experiencing. I don't think it's right, but therapy is the one place that we should talk about this, because I wouldn't be surprised if it's in some way connected to our response to PTSD and the assault and just our overall well-being, which is what we go to therapy for. I hope that makes sense. I know I feel like I was kind of a little scattered. So let me know if you have follow-ups, but I hope that helps. Okay. Final question. Question number 6 says, hey, Katie, I hope you're doing well. As a clinician who watches your videos, hey, I'm wondering if you've ever worked in community mental health. I have, I'll tell you. What would you say CMH, that's community mental health, is doing well versus what's not so good? That can be in a systemic sense of what the clients or clinicians deal with, or just in general. Curious for your input. Yeah, I worked a ton in community mental health. I worked at a place called St. Anne's in downtown Los Angeles in the Rampart Division, which if people know anything about that, it's a very sketchy part of town. And that was a community mental health center. I also worked, it used to be called, I think they've changed the name since I was there because this was like 2008, but I used to work at a place called the Center for Individual and Family Counseling in North Hollywood. If you're looking for low cost mental health care, that's a great place. I think what they're doing well is offering great services. And I had great supervision in both places. What they're not doing well, I don't think, is in dissemination of the resources. I don't think most people even know where clinics like this are. I find it very, very frustrating that when I would tell people in my life about the Center for Individual and Family Counseling, for example, and I would say, yeah, you know, it's as low cost as $20 a session. And my friends would be like, oh my God, that would have been so helpful for my friend. I didn't even know, but now she can afford it. She's in, you know, regular private care, or her health insurance is now covering it. But years ago, I would have loved to know that. Community mental health needs to do more outreach, more awareness. Like, I know both of the places I worked were funded partially through like different either mental health funds within California or federally funded in some way, or they did like fundraisers. I feel like they should be doing some stuff in their local communities, or at the very least, like putting things on local news, like doing a little ad or something, working with creators. I feel like there needs to be a way for people to know, and they've never been good at getting the word out. I feel like that's why our resources are underutilized. And then they become underfunded. It's like St. Anne's, we'd have this big fundraiser every year, and some of it was underwritten by the city, some of it was underwritten by the federal government, and then we had these grants, and we would have to like hustle and do this big fundraiser every year. And I feel, anyways, sometimes we'd be lower on funds and some programs would be cut. And I think that if we let people know about these resources, then we could not only fundraise more, but more people could access it. And then we'd see the utilization going up, and then you're able to get more federal, state, local funding for it. All that kind of works together. I think other than that, I'm trying to think in general. I feel like sometimes the paperwork, this will probably be the last piece I talk about. Sometimes I think that when it comes to any kind of resource that we're able to access, and I think this goes worldwide, because I talk to a lot of you in all sorts of parts of the world, whether we're in somewhere in Europe, you know, Austria, London, Spain, or people out in Australia, I've talked to all of you, and the amount of paperwork that you have to do, or the amount of assessments we have to do, and the time we have to wait for that in order to even gain access, that's super, super frustrating, especially because we all know that when we're feeling really shitty, the last thing we have is motivation to fill out a shit ton of paperwork. And I wish that there was more support to help you fill it out, as well as they should make some very simple YouTube videos on how to fill it out. I feel this way with the IRS too. I feel like a lot of our like federal programs and shit like that, they're like, we have all this money, we've funded all these programs. And I'm like, tell people how to use it then. I didn't even know this existed. How come you're not telling people about it? Yet I know about, I don't know, random wars we're funding or shit like that. Like, that doesn't affect me in the day-to-day. I need to know how to utilize this. You can tell me about that, but also tell me about the stuff that I need to use, right? Like, how do I sign up for food stamps if I need it? How do I access lower cost healthcare, mental health care? How do I get that, right? I feel like there's a big piece there that's missing, and that, you can tell, that frustrates me, because we're such a wealthy nation, and we're such a wealthy world in a lot of ways, and there's tons of resources and things available. I just wish that it was easier for people to find them and easier for them to access. And I know people can be like, well, people will abuse the system if we make it easier. We can still make sure they qualify, but it should be automated. It should be online. There should be a video to walk them through how to fill it out. What is this question asking for? Because sometimes we even use terminology that the regular person's like, I don't know what that means. It also needs to be in a bunch of different languages, because not everybody speaks English, right? There's just things like access, the accessibility of it, that I find really tricky. But overall, all of the community mental health places I've worked at and volunteered at, I find them to be incredibly beneficial. They are there for the community. I've worked with all sorts of different people. It has been helpful for me as a human to be in that experience. Part of me actually kind of misses, I was just like journaling the other day, because I really want to move back to Los Angeles, like yesterday. And I was like, God, I would love to get back into like maybe volunteering like once a month, like spending a day. Maybe we could do it as a community. Like in downtown LA, there's a bunch of like beautiful soup kitchens that offer low cost healthcare and mental health care, and clinicians can come in. So I could donate some hours, we could run groups. So, you know, there's just things that we could do. I kind of miss the community outreach. I used to do way, 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 way more of that. And then COVID kind of, and I haven't gotten back into it. So anyways, sometimes I know people feel like we have to donate money to make things better and to help your community. If you don't have money, donate time. And I get so, you guys, I swear to God, this sounds so bad, but like sometimes I feel like I get more out of it. And I know, not to be like in a selfish way, but I do it with the most altruistic of intentions, but I always come out of those days spent at different clinics and soup kitchens and food banks and stuff like that feeling so fulfilled, so grateful, so just people will warm your heart and it feels good to help other people. So anyway, if you can't donate money, donate your time. But yeah, community mental health has been great. I think that the access could be improved. I think communication of resources available could be improved. Yeah, so I'll try to do more of that. In my videos, I'll try to add in some things that are available. But yeah, those are just my thoughts. Okay. Thank you all so much for listening. I hope you have a wonderful week. Thank you for sending in your questions. Thank you for being part of the community and being so caring to one another. I love seeing it in the comments. You guys are just wonderful. And I look forward to connecting with all of you if you're able on any of the live streams. If you guys don't know, I do them on YouTube and on Patreon. I'll see you all over there. Have a wonderful rest of your week. Do your homework and I'll talk to you next time. Bye.